Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. And this is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. If we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known purely for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together. Much of that you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number on the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the limit and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you for giving us that great disclaimer. I appreciate that. Let me just share some things with you to begin with, and then we'll bring PJ aboard. I see he's here on the call. Great. So we just want to share some things with you and possibly make that a lifting point for PJ to go on about what we're talking about here tonight. When I came into this world, when I had my first breath day, my first day of breath, somewhere south of Canada, somewhere north of Mexico, somewhere east of the Pacific, somewhere west of the Atlantic. By birthright, I enjoyed being a first-class citizen. Later in life, I entered into contracts without my knowledge that actually turned me into a second-class citizen. I was surprised to find that the United States government actually recognizes two distinct and unique classes of citizens, let alone that, and did not know that I could translate from one to the other. At first, I didn't believe it. It was not until I learned how to use a law library in the county courthouse that I was able to confirm my status. So I want to talk about some of the things that I've learned in the courthouse. Words and phrases. Let me share why I believe this. To show that Congress has made laws that are unreadable by the average person, an objective method of measuring the readability of the English language needs to be addressed. English scholars use a scale known as the Flesch Index. This measures the level of understanding necessary for an individual to comprehend the written English language. Newspapers are at an average comprehensive level of 7. The average high school graduate reads and understands at a level of 10. The average law school graduate reads and comprehends at a level of 15. The Internal Revenue Code ranks on this index at an average of 31, with some specific provisions as high as 55. And the words that are used in law, they have specific legal definitions that are often different from the common English definitions. If the laws that we're supposed to obey are written at a level that an individual of reasonable intelligence cannot understand, then perhaps we should be highly suspect of the laws of the writer of these motives. My word processor, the grammar checker, tells me that most of my writing is done at about 11, 11 and a half, 12. People in this country cannot understand, most people in this country cannot understand at that level, and I have to tone it down, ratchet it down. How many people have the time and energy and ability to go to a law library and put all this together? To show how the government uses common English words in such a way that they have meanings that are different from what we might think. I'll show you how the word state is redefined. In the IRS code, it says that you are a subject, that you are subject to the income tax if you live in one of the states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, Guam, or Northern Mariana Islands. From this definition, it sounds as if I need to pay an income tax. But if you look at how the IRS defines the word state, you probably will be confused as well. In the definition of the word state, it uses the word state. If you check this definition in years back, you'll see it has been modified several times. Before Alaska was admitted into the Union, so this is before 1959, I think of 59 or 58, it was in this list of states before Alaska was admitted into the Union. And after it became one of the states of the Union, it was no longer listed in the definition, IRS definitions of a state. The same thing happened to Hawaii. What does this mean? The definition that is used in the Internal Revenue Code for the word state is not a state like Texas or Alabama or any of the other states of the Union, but a state like Guam. That is, they're talking about a federal territory, calling it a state. So far, I've stated some unconventional ideas possibly to some first-time callers tonight. To substantiate them, I'll cite a few standing decisions by courts and statute passed by the Congress. Unless the decision or statute is in quotation marks, these statutes are in quotation marks. This is Lansing versus Smith, quote, "People of a state are entitled to all rights which formerly belonged to the king by his prerogative." In Chisholm versus Georgia, quote, "At the Revolution, the sovereignty devolved on the people, and they are truly the sovereigns of this country, but they are sovereigns without subjects and have none to govern but themselves. The citizens of America are equal as fellow citizen and as joint tenants in their sovereignty." In Newman, this is a 1925 decision, quote, "As general rule, men have natural right to do anything which their inclinations may suggest, if it be not evil in itself, and in no way impairs the rights of others." The United States is a foreign corporation with respect to a state. This is Merriam. Title 28, United States Code, Section 297, defines several states of the Union as being, quote, oh, you've heard me on this, freely associated compact states, end quote, in subsection A, and then refers to these freely associated compact states as being countries in subsection B. Did you know that the individual states were considered to be foreign countries to the United States and to each other? In 1818, the Supreme Court stated that, quote, "In the United States of America, there are two separated and distinct jurisdictions, such being the jurisdiction of the states within their own state boundaries, and the other being federal jurisdictions in the United States, which is limited to the District of Columbia, the U.S. territories, and federal enclaves within the state under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, end quote. This is U.S. Versus Bevins. When Congress is operating in an exclusive jurisdiction over the District of Columbia, the territories and enclaves, it's important to remember that it has full authority to enact legislation as private acts pertaining to its boundaries, and it is not a state of the union of states because it exists solely by virtue of the compact, the Constitution, that we the people created. The Constitution does not say that the District of Columbia must guarantee a republican form of government to its own subject citizens within its territories. Hep and Dundas versus Elsey, Glazer versus Acacia Mutual Life Assurance, Long versus District of Columbia, Americana of Puerto Rico versus Capas. The dates on these are 1805, 1944, 1987, and 1966. That's very recent, isn't it? So what I want to share with you at this time is that these court cases clearly delineate between a citizen of one of the freely associated compact states with rights versus a federal citizen that only has privileges to the extent that the Congress will allow them to have, and those privileges are evidenced by you asking them to do something and then them issuing license so that you can do it. Without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to PJ.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. It's very interesting when they started doing these border checks along the border between Mexico and what they would call United States. They they ask you, are you a U.S. citizen? And most people don't know that that can be asked in a very deceptive way, because if you don't specifically state the kind of U.S. citizen that you're referencing, they can take it as a federal governable entity. Basically, better said, a federal person. State, absolutely. State is defined in the state statute, generally under the word state or in this state or this state. Michael, can you think of a couple others maybe? State, in this state, that's the ones that are most common. And you go and you check, you look up the definition of those terms. For example, in this state, you wouldn't think that was a unified term, in this state. But it'll have its own definition. In this state will have its own definition. And you go look it up, and it'll say the definition is a possession or territory of the United States. Okay, so it sounds very much like a federal zone, doesn't it? This state will have the same definition. It'll say possession or territory of the United States. And then the word state all by itself will say possession or territory of the United States. So when they talk about the state of Texas, they're not talking about Texas. They're talking about a possession or territory of the United States of Texas. That's what state of Texas means. And if you're in a U.S. court and they're flying a U.S. flag, and every single court I've ever been in, there's always been a U.S. flag. And there's a reason why that U.S. flag is in there, because they are giving notice to the participant that it's a U.S. court. It's not just a court, it's a U.S. court. Another way of saying a U.S. court is that it's a federal court, that it's a court of the United States. I've been in county court, and I asked the judge, is this the United States court? And he said, yes, it's the United States court. And if you're in a United States court, guess what terms operate, definitions operate? The definitions that are found in the United States statutes. If you go into the United States statutes, words like the word resident, words like state, of course, word like county, all are used to describe a federal zone or a federal person. And if you're doing business activity in a federal zone, you are a subject to the federal written law. If you're a federal person, you're a person subject to the United States written laws, generally. They claim that a U.S. person no matter where he makes his money, his income is taxable. No matter where he makes it, he can make it in Germany, he can make it in Russia, he can make it in Texas, or he can make it in the state of Texas. It's all taxable by the federal government. I've read cases where the judge said that because the defendant did not challenge when they said that he lived in a zip, that he was doing a business in a zip code area, the judge said that, well, you didn't challenge it when they brought that into court, that therefore the evidence is on the record that you were doing business in a federal zone. So that zip code is a, it stands for Zoning Improvement Project. And whose zoning improvement project is it? It's the federal zoning improvement project. So when you're in a U.S. court and they start talking about identifying a area with a zip code or the word county, they're actually getting on the record that you're doing activity in a federal zone. And if they must get that on the record for the U.S. court administrator to have evidence of administrative ability there. He does not have administrative ability without the United States. He only has United States administrative ability within the United States. Now, they'll oftentimes put a witness in the witness stand and just rattle this stuff off that you did an activity in the state of Texas, for example, in the state of Missouri, in the state of Alabama, and the opposing party doesn't know how to object and force them to produce evidence that it was in a federal zone. That's one way they get it on there. And another way they get it on is they put you in the witness stand and they ask you if it occurred in the state or in the county, or they'll ask you for an address and hoping that you'll give an address with a zip code, so the judge will use that as a federal locator. And they'll run with that. And you won't know what hit, what, you just got ran over by a freight train, you didn't even know it. So anytime you're in a U.S. court, any U.S. court, may it be county, state, or an appeals court, or a United States district court, they need to get that on the record. If they do get it on the record, then it's used against you as doing activity in a federal zone. So what you do is when you work with us, we have a process of taking care of that business before you get to court. And if you do it right, they dismiss the case because they are basically given notice that they cannot come in administratively against you, and the only jurisdiction that's left is common law. And if they come in under common law, they're not allowed to use attorneys, and the rules of common law operate, which means that the jury besides all the law and the facts, the judge has almost no ability in that courtroom to basically box you in and destroy your case. It's extreme. It's beyond. I am just shocked that these federal judges do not retire. And I have friends that have worked with these federal judges, and many of them are very, not many of them, but some of them are patriots. They're patriots. They are very, extremely cautious about sticking their head up. I think they know that they'll be blacklisted or killed. They've spent a lifetime of getting a position and in society, and they don't want to ruin it. I think that if they do stick their head up, there's probably something in their past that they can blackmail them with. Maybe a tax issue, something like that. I don't know. But, or they'll frame them. We had a family in Nebraska that was testifying against the local sheriff, and the father woke up one day and told the family that, hey, we're going to go down to the lake today. Get your stuff together and let's head down to the lake and enjoy a time at the lake. You know, we're going through all this government stuff and we want to relax. So he goes out and opens the trunk of his car that's parked in his garage. And I knew a friend that lived right beside him. And he said this neighbor came running over to him and was hollering at his neighbors, come over here quickly. And they thought, man, you know what, somebody died or what? They run over there and they look in his trunk, and his trunk is full of guns. So they believe that what they were going to do is pull that family over and kill them. Start a gunfight, kill them, and when they did their business, they would pull up with a camera, fill the crime scene, they'd pop the trunk, and it would be full of guns. Amazing. It's just beyond me that they would go to such levels to frame individuals. But it does not, you know, not everybody in the government does this, but it's that 1 or 5% that will do this, and that's the 1 or 5% that'll come against you in a federal courtroom, especially for federal taxes. Michael, any questions popping up?
Well, let me check. *2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press *2. For those of you on Freedom's Radio, simply look to the rectangle laying on its side in the center of your monitor. Empty, left click inside of it and type away your comment or question, then hit refresh. Thinking that someone might have already done that, let me check there to see. Nope. And no one's raised their hand yet. That's *2 on your keypad. Go ahead.
Just give me a shout if somebody does. We had an individual that was talking to a federal judge. He was talking to three federal judges. A lot of these guys are retired. And we don't have any we have no permission to give out their names. But three federal judges are sitting together, speaking with one of these people that I've worked with. This is quite a while ago in the past, and they started talking about the elements of jurisdiction, and they started talking about, you know, they've got to prove that the person is subject to the written laws of the United States. They got to prove that the written law operates against the activity that's claimed to have occurred. And then they got to prove that the written law operates in a specific land where they claim the activity took place, where the person did the activity in that land. And I think there was three federal judges sitting there and two high-level district judges of the state. And two of the federal judges said that they didn't know what territorial jurisdiction meant, because they've been told that they have jurisdiction in all the states. And that's true. They do have jurisdiction in all the states. If you look at the definition of state in the state statutes, because it'll say that it's the federal possession or territory of the United States. And the other judges had to explain to these two federal judges that, you know, if you're a federal judge, you've been a judge for many years. You don't just, that's not just your first, you had to start lower level courts and work your way up. And my friend, he said he was just shocked that even after they explained territorial jurisdiction to these two federal judges, they said that, well, they said that we kind of understand, but we still don't understand. And the reason they don't understand is because they had a whole lifetime that's packed away in their brain of completely ignoring anything to do with territorial jurisdiction. So if you're in any U.S. court and you challenge territorial jurisdiction, the judges will just roll. Most judges will just roll their eyes. Very few will actually give you any attention at all. And usually the ones that give you attention are the ones that are actually patriot-minded, and their career is just about over because as soon as they get that way, they're removed from office. But generally, they will just scoff at you and laugh and try to make you feel like there's no merit to it at all. Territorial jurisdiction is to such a level of threat, and it's such a threat to them that anymore, you pretty much have to have possibly a federal marshal standing there that's been briefed on territorial jurisdiction. And then you have to address the moving party and the U.S. court judge to produce evidence of territorial jurisdiction. And you got to let them know that you have a U.S. marshal here that's going to arrest them if they don't prove it up and they continue to prosecute or move against you. That, it's got that bad that that's what you have to do. Now, after people across the country that have worked with some of the lawyers that I work with, they've got wind of this. They've sent memos out to all the U.S. marshals that they're not allowed to do this. Now, we believe that that's unconstitutional because the U.S. marshals are our marshals. They are not their marshals. So we have a constitutional right to use the U.S. marshals to uphold the law in a U.S. court. So they've made it very difficult. Most U.S. marshals nowadays are not brave enough to actually be employed by you in that capacity. They just will pass. There are a few out there, and they're getting less and less every day. Of course, the Lord can get a hold of them at any time and open their eyes, but it's difficult to find a U.S. marshal that will stand there and be prepared to arrest a U.S. judge, because the U.S. Marshal is the only person that can arrest a U.S. Marshal, a U.S. judge, while acting in the bench position. But they do have authority to do that. Believe it or not, it's written right in their authority that they can do that. So if they witness a crime in the U.S. courtroom, see, they're in that courtroom for not only to aid the judge, but to aid the American people. Of course, you would never know they're here there to aid the American people, but it's in their job description. That's why they're there. You would think that they're completely subservient to the federal judge. And the federal judge behaves in such a way as to intimidate them so that they think that they don't even know that they're how broad their jurisdiction is and their authority is. Very extremely interesting. So get your questions out and put your hands up for Michael, and he'll call on you.
Because if you don't, we'll have an early call tonight. All right, Miss Jennifer, thank you.
Go ahead, Miss Jennifer.
Thank you. I just thought I'd ask, if we can't use marshals, can we not use constitutional sheriffs? Or because they're a sheriff and not a marshal, that we can't use them? And what do we do now if there aren't any marshals left to do that? How else can we entice a judge to do the right thing?
We don't know exactly what the remedy is right now. I mean, if you have a informed U.S. marshal that's willing to be brave, you don't have a big problem. But, of course, like I said, they're getting fewer and fewer all the time. Anybody in the courtroom, is better than nobody in the courtroom. So now I had a case in Northern District, Florida that I won, and I was the only person to win a case down there in 8 or 9 years. Nobody was winning. Nobody won a case at all that went to trial. People won cases, but not the ones that went to trial. The ones that went to trial, every single person in that U.S. District Court lost to the United States. So, the reason I bring that up is they would not even allow people to bring a notebook or a pen into the courtroom. Of course, you can't bring your phones in because you might record the court proceedings. Those court proceedings are open to the public. Now, open to the public means open to the public. And I talked to a high-level lawyer that says that really does mean that you can come in there and record the proceedings. Now, in state statutes that I've studied, it says that you can record the proceedings as long as you do not interfere with the court's proceedings. So some high-level judges and lawyers that I talked to, they said what that means is, you can turn the recorder on, and as long as you're not as long as it's not disturbing the proceedings, you have a right to do that. Now, you try to do that in a courtroom, and the judge will make you turn it right off. So you need to be prepared to read the state statute to them and the constitutional provision that the courts are open. The courts are either open, which would include, the sidewalks are open. You can turn a recorder on out there. And why, if the courts are open, court is a location, the sidewalk is a location, why can't you turn the recorder on? Now, they claim that you can't use a recorder in there because people in the past have taken those recorders and they dissected portions out and they made the judge sound like you said something else, stuff like that. But so what? I can do the same thing with a pen and paper. I can say the judge said this and this and leave out a third of his words and completely changed his message.
Or well, they would have said, they do that to you, but you can't do that to them.
That's right. Now, I was in a U.S. court once, and the prosecutor says, hey, PJ's recording, Your Honor, PJ's recording. And the judge looked at the prosecutor and says, Mr. Prosecutor, we're recording too. Move ahead. Go ahead. So, because that judge knew that I've addressed that in the past, that if we have a right to record, we have a right to have our eyes open in that courtroom. We have a right to have many eyes open in that courtroom. We have a right to have many ears in the courtroom and many ears open in that courtroom. They're called, the courts are to be open to the public.
Right.
So, generally, generally when you get yourself in a bind, your friends will leave here very quickly. Out of 50 friends, you might get one or two that will actually show up and hide in the back of the courtroom like a scared little cat. But, that's about the best I've ever been able to get out of my friends. It's really sad. Mm. To where, when I have a friend in the courtroom, I walk in right in the front row.
Right.
And I have my notepad there, and I am taking notes like a professional court reporter. I always tell people, go into the courtroom, make it look like you're a professional reporter, What do they call those reporters that just, they get a good story and then they sell it to whoever they can? Freelance reporter. And said, I tell them, every time you do that, they're going to send a sheriff in there and they're going to try to find out who you are. And then, because I've had friends do it. And the sheriff will walk up and says, the judge would like to know who you are. Oh, is that so? I'm a individual that's sitting here exercising my right to an open court. And the sheriff says, well, what's your business here? Private. He says, well, what's your private business here? And then the guy says, private. So didn't get nothing out of him. But then the sheriff gave up. And I've been in court before where I was standing up in the court facing the judge, and they went to each person in the courtroom and asked them to leave. And I turned around, and all my friends left except for one.
Wow.
And the one that stayed was the least likely one I thought was going to stay. And he stayed and witnessed them remove one of my briefs from the record. I had a brief in there, a very powerful brief that just shut them down big time. On, can't remember exactly. I got two main briefs, anyway, it shut them down big time. If they get it into the record, it puts the judge in a terrible position.
Hmm.
Anyway, I filed that into the record, and they. When I was walking out of the courtroom, the court clerk says, "Hey, Mr. BJ, you left some documents here." And I said, "No, I filed that into the record." And the judge says, "No, you didn't file that into the record." I said, "Your Honor, I think I need to remind you. You see that man sitting right there? He's there for a reason today. He's there to testify to in any U.S. court that I did file that into the record." And then the judge said, "Okay. Okay, we'll accept that into the record then." That paper wasn't going to go into the record without that one witness sitting there. Unfortunately, one person sitting behind. Go ahead with your question.
Have you heard of the Constitutional Sheriffs like group? And have you ever spoken to them about helping in any way?
Yeah. Yes, we're. They're a pretty good group. I think Sheriff Mack is pretty good, but
right.
He seems to be lacking a lot of information on common law courts and things like that. Now, when I say common law courts, I'm talking about the people's courts.
Well, is he willing to learn? Is he willing to be given it more?
The United States courts are United States courts. And the people's courts are the people's courts. Those are two different courts. Now, what did you say? I was talking over you. Can you say that again?
Sorry. I was just wondering, is he willing to, you said that he hasn't got a lot of information about it, but is he willing to learn, to be given information and, like, have some sort of role that helps us when we have to go to court if there aren't enough marshals?
Yes, that he is. And I had a friend that was a law expert. That's what I'll call him, a law expert. Now, he might be a federal judge. He might be one of the highest ranked lawyers in the nation. But anyway, I'm not going to say. But he's up there. And he met with 42 mayors. And 110 sheriffs. And now there's a lot of sheriffs in the nation. I think there's 1,000 some sheriffs in the nation. But he had 110 of them together on one line, and he was explaining to them the distinctions of jurisdiction and the rights and the powers of the people. Because the rights and the powers of the people are very similar to the rights and the power of the sheriff. So, he was explaining that to them that the jurisdiction of the people is higher than the jurisdiction of the sheriff, of the U.S. Marshals. Because that is the people are the supreme law of the land. I mean, they're the sovereigns. if you define the word properly. The U.S. administrators, U.S. Supreme Court, they are not at the same level as the people. They're employees, and they're part-time employees. They don't like to be reminded of this, that the people are higher than they are. The United States Court is not the highest court in the land, but they are always quoted as the highest court in the land. They are the highest court in the land of the United States. They're not the highest court of the American people, not even close. The American people are the highest jurisdiction. We have law and we have a constitution that proves that. Go ahead with another question. You got good questions there.
Oh, well, I was just thinking then, if we're above the judge as well, how can he have so much power in his courtroom kind of thing?
Well,
when we're the people above.
A lot of their power is bluff. Let's say, for example, that you learned about the federal tax laws and the proper application of them, and then you sent out our material, and for the last 10 years, for example, and the IRS finally comes after you, and you end up in U.S. court, and you challenge the moving party, which is the United States, to produce evidence that you have a requirement to file and pay. And the judge ignores your challenge. We go in and we file criminal complaints against the judge. We file documents for you, have the judge recuse themselves. I don't know if we do this immediately or not. Now the criminal complaint, we do that pretty quickly, while the judge is still even presiding over your case. But in some situations, we may even go in and initiate a civil federal suit against that individual for damages. But anyway, we hit them. And the same way with the court clerks. If the court clerks get in interfering with your due process. See, the judge is not allowed to violate any of your rights, and neither is the court clerks. So as soon as they violate your rights, and you can file a criminal complaint against them. And the criminal complaints go to the federal prosecutor, and at the very least, you establish a record. And generally, when the criminal complaint is filed, if it has any level of, you know, authority behind it, you know, a reasonable affidavit, things like that, the federal judge generally has to step down from office. And a lot of these federal judges are tyrannical. High percentage of them are tyrannical judges. So the next judge you get in might not be any better. But after you go through about two or three of them, you're probably going to hit one that's going to pay attention to the Bill of Rights after that. Because he doesn't, when they get a criminal complaint filed against them, I've been told that those federal judges generally have to pitch out between $30,000 to $150,000 out of their own personal pocket to pay for a lawyer to deal with that criminal complaint. That's what I've been told. If it's a valid criminal complaint.
There's one other thing too that we're developing at this time, or PJ and his associates are developing at this time, and that is the bond, the insurance policy that the judge has, and to find out what the bond company is at the very beginning. And when you file against the bond for deprivation of rights, the person bonded, and that's any public employee, whether they are employed, hired, elected, appointed, doesn't matter. If they're a public servant, the bond must be at place, and whether it's a umbrella bond that the state uses or it's an individual bond, which is what it's supposed to be, going after their bond, filing a complaint, is something that will jack up the price of their insurance or put them at the risk of losing their insurance or losing their bond. And
Michael,
they become personal.
I got a question for you, Michael. Is that bond there to protect the people or to protect the judge?
Well, in this case here, it's a two-edged sword.
Yeah, but it's primarily there to protect people like you and I, correct?
That's right. So anyways, there's a homemaker. When I say just a homemaker, I am not belittling that role at all. That's one of the toughest jobs there are. But this homemaker has an autistic son that was forced to wear a mask in order to go to school, and it sent him into hyperventilation and distress, emotional distress. Being an autistic child, he was functioning autistic. Anyways, the bottom line is she went after the school board superintendent's bond, and that superintendent was left out to dry, owing an incredible amount of money. And the school board immediately changed its policy to say that masks were optional. All right, we have one more question that we want to take care of, Jennifer, before we go home tonight. Can we do that?
Well, I just was going to ask, if I have sent affidavits to county employees, and like two, and they haven't responded, or they've responded by saying, well, we need this or we need that, and then I haven't given them that, does that mean they've kind of won or
no? I think you have rate recourse and remedy through the bond.
Uh-huh.
Exploring that now. It's another arrow in the quiver that we're looking to bring in.
Okay, great. I'll let you go. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Next is Jerry from Missouri.
Hello, Michael and PJ.
Show me what you got.
Thanks for having me.
Something good.
Well, this is really a great insight tonight. You know, I am a constitutional sheriff under Sheriff Mack, and I agree. They don't have any information, and I'm looking to learn so that I can take some information back and educate some of the constitutional sheriffs. In regards to the bond, it's my belief, I believe you remember, Michael, I told you I was working with Mizell and Turner years ago, and
right.
I learned that the judges have a bond, and that bond is basically their bond to protect them against the people. That's what I was told years ago. Now, I had a bankruptcy. I went against the judge in Union, Missouri, and I didn't go past the swinging gates. I stood my ground with he and City Mortgage. And the judge kept postponing the trial. But I did notify him that I would go after his bond.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, if you want to proceed with that, there's a lot of challenges that you can bring forward as a matter of law before they can a lot of these banks, for example, can proceed. What we're learning is the banks, we have vice presidents notify us and say, I didn't know that we were required to do this or that or register this or keep that keep such record. And, you know, this is news to us. And when push comes to shove, they admit that, you know, we're going to have to yield to you guys because we don't want to go to jail today. So it's extremely interesting. Congress, a lot of times when the bill is brought forward, these are highly educated people in the banking industry, for example, and they have hundreds of years of knowledge compiled together, and they know a lot of these people knew what needs to be put in place so that the banks wouldn't basically rip off the people. Or unequal weights and, you know, bank fraudulently putting money into circulation that the bank never had control of, things like that. They basically undermine the people's wealth. It's really what the banks do. That's why we get inflation. But anyway, those safeguards are in place, and when you present them as a matter of law and they're not doing it, they're in a position of losing their charter. And if they continue to do it, once they've been noticed, it's a felony, and they're off to jail they go. So it's pretty exciting to have you know, the sheriffs on board on this, because the law is so expansive, and we've been taught poorly in relationship to the law, and even the Bill of Rights. It's amazing that some of these legal high-level lawyers that Michael and I work with, when they explain to us the Bill of Rights, how it's such a wonderful tool to bring forward in a U.S. courtroom. I mean, they have to prove that your rights are not operative. And they have a terrible time doing that at times. Go ahead.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I believe the constitutional sheriffs are very important. We've got some great sheriffs in Missouri. I'm in Franklin County. And we need the constitutional sheriffs to take this information back to the sheriffs so that they can be educated. Most of the sheriffs here will back the Patriots. I'd say about 99% of them will back the Patriots, but they need to be educated. And hopefully we can get more people like myself to get involved and do that. You know,
What state are you in?
I'm in Missouri. I'm in Washington, Missouri.
Yeah. Yeah. What one thing that's been extremely interesting recently is we work with high level legal minds on this. And like I said, some of them are retired federal judges. And, you know, we have packages put together, and let's just say that somebody's coming after you for property taxes. You know, let's say your mom and dad bought this house for $20,000, you know, way back when you were a baby. Now they're paying $20,000 a year for property taxes. Like, and it's putting them in a tremendous bind. Every year they're just on the edge of losing their property. And they wake up like, you know, what is wrong with this? My place is paid for and I can barely make payments. So we meet with these high level, legal minds, and they start explaining to us that property taxes are only to be applied on government owned land. So if you formulate your case properly, they are dead in the water, because some of the land around here, the government has a nexus to the land because of mineral rights, water rights, something, you know.
Sure.
But most of the land is completely clear, and they have no taxing authority at all. So we have clients that are paying $15,000 to $20,000 a month on a year on property taxes, and we come in with the arguments and we show the treasurer and the county assessor that they must produce evidence that that land is of the United States to be taxable as a matter of law. And boy, it's, we get threats from people, we get death threats, and we get judgments that are sealed where the federal court actually says that there is no taxes owed. But the judge, one judge said that, you know, you got to seal this case. Your guys' lives are in danger. So, you know, what do you think of when, as a sheriff? What do you think of when you hear a story like that? Does it sound bizarre, or do you think there's a possibility that it's true?
Well, I know it's true. Mm-hmm. You know, I can tell you, I know that it's true. It's incredible the things that I've seen in my 73 years. I was deputized by a U.S. Marshal, and back in my youth, I was on the police department in one of the communities that's a suburb east of Franklin County. And I've seen some things in my career, my lifetime, that just absolutely would blow your mind. But I think that you are absolutely doing some great things right now, because we're in a time where people need to know their rights. They need to be able to stand their ground. And I really believe that the sheriffs will play a large part in helping people. But we've got to get the constitutional sheriffs to get the information back to the sheriffs, because most of them really, really want to help their citizens, because we're in these, I guess you could call them smaller towns, where we know all the sheriffs and, you know, we communicate with them and we go to church with them. We do things with them. And I think it's very important that the constitutional sheriffs get involved and try and educate the sheriffs around the country.
They're very much grassroots sheriffs, aren't they?
Yes, yes.
Very much. And if we get a vast majority of the grassroots sheriffs educated, man, you can change a lot that's going on in the country, because the people in the city go, they look over the hill and they say, hey, you know, these guys are getting treated well over there. How come we can't get treated that way? And it spreads. So, okay, Michael, before we run out of time, Michael, what's next on the agenda?
The next agenda is say goodnight, everybody. Thank you so much for joining
us,
Jerry. Thank you for your comments.
I'm sure Michael's gears are running that, you know, we can meet with some of these sheriffs, and metal sharpens metal, so we're looking forward to that.
I just made a note on this recording to remember it. So, I have Sheriff Max information, and I just added your name and number to it, Jerry. Thank you.
Oh, great, great. Thank you.
There's a time coming.
Yeah,
we
have a program put together for sheriffs, so and we're expanding on that daily. Okay, go ahead, Michael.
No, I'm just saying that prayerfully an event's going to take place that is a long time in the making, that when it does, we're going to take everything that we're doing national. And when I do that, once I've created my office staff, if you would, and the people that I will be directly associating with, like PJ and others like that, I refer to them as the team, then we'll be reaching out. We'll be reaching out to Sheriff Mack and others, yourself, as an introduction. One of the things that I think that we need to do is to create litigation that will take us to a certain place, so that we can have something that's case precedent to deal with. When a court case is sealed, it's sealed from the general view of the general public, but it's still very, very much alive and very usable. If you have certified copies of the filings that are in that case, and you can get them every day that, that you visit the clerk of court, you pay for them, and you've got this stack, they can be used by anybody that you want to share it with. So that's what I intend to one of the things that I intend to do with PJ's effort and so forth. So, Ron, you've lifted up your hand, and Coke, we're going to, because I know you've got good things to say, we're going to let Ron say what he'd like to say.
Okay.
Unmute your phone, Ron.
Hello, try again.
There you go. See, it works.
Yeah. Just curiosity, what's your position on the Utah grand jury program?
I'd have to look at it. Most of these grand jury are lacking a tremendous amount of knowledge, and they can get themselves in a lot of trouble. But we do have people that, as I've been listing their credentials, that are on top of this and actually working together to help these groups develop basically common law organized groups that do not act in such a way of interfering with United States jurisdictions. Usually these grand jury, these jurisdictions, they stick their heads up, and they're not very good at understanding the distinctions in the boundary lines of the United States courts. You do not take a common law court and drag it into a U.S. Zone. You don't do that. You go in there with permission the same way they have to come to you with permission. So, and that's where they get in a lot of trouble. They are extremely valid, and they are of the people's jurisdiction, and, very important. They have a lot to do with, the sheriff, the operation of the sheriff too, because the sheriff is to stand by. The sheriff is supposed to, enforce any judgment that has due process. So that can come out of a U.S. court, and that can come out of a common law's court, as long as it has due process. Due process is a fair, God-honoring a trial proceeding. So it's not rocket science. Does that help answer your question?
Yes. Did either of you happen to attend the meeting Sunday afternoon that was presented by the Utah?
I'd like to. Michael, go ahead and get that stuff to Michael, and we'll get on that. If I find out they're a solid group, I'll be a part of it in a big way.
After the call, I'll call Michael, or he can call
okay.
me.
Now, in the future, I would assume that Michael and the group that I work with also will actually have a limited forum only for sheriffs, because that would be a very good national thing to link together to have educational times that we can answer questions extremely thoroughly that any sheriff in America can look at the list of questions and listen to it and get the answers that they're looking for. Okay, go ahead, Michael.
No, that was it. Ron is
okay.
I'm going to talk to Ron as soon as this call is over. Ron,
okay.
You got my number,
close
right?
Up.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, just call me in 2 minutes. Thanks. Well, I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. Until next week, good night and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.